Welcome to Federal Insights for October, sponsored by KPMG.
How deeply should the federal government be involved in cyber attacks that are costly to the private sector? When the attacks come from nation states, insurers wash their hands of liability, calling them acts of war. My next guest urges Congress to renew the Terrorism Risk Insurance Act and extend or imitate its provisions to certain cybersecurity attacks. Scott R. Anderson is a fellow in governance studies at the Brookings Institution, and he joins me now in studio. Scott, good to have you in.
Thank you for having me.
So tell us the premise here that there have been private sector U.S. entities that have been materially harmed in pretty major ways by foreign launched cyber attacks.
Yeah, that's exactly right. We're in an era now where we have seen cyber technology become both an integral part of all sorts of businesses around the world, integrating them in a variety of ways, and sometimes exposing them to somewhat unpredictable risks. At the same time, we've also seen this spike of involvement by foreign actors, particularly foreign state actors, in using those cyber vulnerabilities to advance state policies in various ways. And on top of that, we are also in a period where we are starting to think about cyber in this terms of cyber war, cyber attacks, treating cyber as if it's an extension of armed conflict. A lot of times that vocabulary isn't used appropriately. That's not the way legally you would think about a lot of cyber activity, but it nonetheless creates these sorts of impressions about there being a relationship between cyber warfare and cyber acts and cyber warfare, and it creates very complicated questions regarding particularly insurance policies, as we wrote about here.
Sure, and in your article in Lawfare, and we should also mention you're a senior editor and counsel at Lawfare, you cite an example where the losses to a company were not just a few dollars, but it was really major company-threatening types of situations.
That's absolutely right. Specifically, we talked there about a lawsuit regarding the Mondelez company, which is a kind of large food conglomerate that claimed to have suffered $100 million or more, really in excess of $100 million in damages from the NotPetya attack, which was a ransomware-like attack that occurred in 2017 and that basically debilitated a lot of their computer systems, caused lots of damage, actually could have caused much more damage if it weren't caught through a kind of fortunate turn of events somewhat early. And they were not the only ones affected. Many other companies were affected by NotPetya as well. And NotPetya is widely believed and has been attributed by the United States government, the UK government, and a few other governments as being a product of Russia, something that they deployed initially in the Ukraine as part of their ongoing conflict with the Ukraine that then spun out of control, began working its way into private computer systems and affected other actors worldwide.
And one of the issues, I guess, with whatever regime for helping companies with federal involvement in some manner, the problem of attribution of where the attack actually came from, that's a difficulty too, isn't it?
That's exactly right. The U.S. intelligence community has kind of released a statement describing some of the challenges of attribution. And they make the point that even for an intelligence community with the capabilities and background expertise of the United States intelligence community, one of the best in the world, it can be an extended process. And that even when you're really looking at it, while you have a strong guess, strong inclination from the outset, there may be ambiguities or uncertainties. You may never know 100% who the responsible actor is. And that really matters because under existing insurance policies, who the actual actor is can play a major role in the coverage that insurance providers claim that they are obligated to provide.
Yes. Yeah, so if it can be proved to originate from within Russia, that doesn't necessarily mean it's the Russian government. And for that matter, it could be made to look like it's coming from Russia, but actually originate in Great Britain or the United States.
That's a possibility. It's also possible that various state actors really are working through relationships with non-state actors. We know that the Russian government kind of tacitly, too actively, somewhere on that spectrum, facilitates and allows itself to be a hub for different types of cyber criminal activities, some of which are then deployed as methods as part of state-run actions as well. So the line between state action and private action is blurrier in cyberspace, particularly in some of these large-scale cyber attack / large-scale cyber crime sorts of incidents. And again, that creates issues with attribution and then issues with this insurance angle as well.
Scott Anderson is a fellow in governance studies at the Brookings Institution and senior editor and counsel at Lawfare. I'm Tom Temin.
Innovation
Everyone says it. At KPMG, we know actions speak louder than words. For over 100 years, KPMG has helped federal agencies adapt to changing times with innovative approaches. Today, we're helping agencies advance in areas like cybersecurity, artificial intelligence, blockchain, cognitive analytics, and secure cloud. Let our past experience help propel your future forward more quickly and with greater agility and efficiency. Become future ready with KPMG. Visit futurereadygovernment.com.
We're speaking with Scott Anderson. He's a fellow in governance studies at the Brookings Institution and senior editor and counsel at Lawfare. And talk about the Terrorism Risk Insurance Act, which Congress is going to at some point take up debating the extension of it. How does that work in the non-cyber area?
Sure. TRIA was developed after the 9/11 attacks to address what was kind of a similar or parallel market failure or potential market failure, something that we were worried we might be able to see. My co-author, Aaron Klein, and I should say, or worried we might see in the cyberspace as well. And that was a case where after the 9/11 attacks, insurance providers said from the outset, under kind of pressure from the Bush administration, we are not going to invoke this active war exception. This is a provision in insurance contracts that say when damages arise from an act of war by a foreign state actor, they are outside the scope of coverage of insurance policies. They said, we're not going to cover that. But then they started rewriting their insurance policies to exclude acts of terrorism more expressly than under active war provisions, because they were worried about the sorts of damages they may face from catastrophic acts of terrorism,
so that would
series
even,
of 9/11 attacks.
That would even protect the insurance companies from homegrown U.S.-based terrorism, like the Timothy McVeighs of the world?
Potentially. It depends on how the terms are written. And there's no real standard contract. Remember, these are insurance companies revising their contracts in a variety of different ways. But this was a trend that people saw and that that the United States government was worried about at the time. So we saw the Secretary of Treasury go to Congress and say, we are worried that we are going to be in a situation where there could be a market failure around the coverage for these catastrophic acts of terrorism, where that is the situation where American companies and American property owners are going to be most in need of insurance coverage to mitigate the risk. Yet we see that the insurance providers are too worried about the potential coverage, about the fact how they're going to set their premiums to cover their costs, because that's how insurance works. You know, you're supposed to be using the premiums to cover the eventual payouts that may arise. Pricing, it's very difficult because it's such a difficult phenomenon to gauge and estimate when it happens, how it happens, and the damage.
It's very rare, but the costs can be extremely high.
Exactly. And it should be noted, after the 9/11 attacks, we didn't know how rare it was going to be. I think there was a concern that we were going to see more 9/11 type attacks. We've been fortunate that we haven't. But at the time, I think that was part of driving this concern, saying we're going to see a lot more of these. Maybe this is going to become a very expensive thing to start covering, and we haven't been charging enough for it. So what the United States did is it established a federal backstop through the Terrorist Risk Insurance Act that it's renewed several times since. And effectively how this works, it says that insurance companies are obligated to provide insurance for acts of terrorism. But if those damages rise to a certain threshold and it's determined by the Secretary of the Treasury that the type of damages did in fact arise from a terrorist attack that's covered by TRIA, the kind of qualifying act, then the federal government would step in and provide a backstop and essentially help cover some of the exposure of the insurance companies.
So it's like
for that
the
period.
It's like the Medicare Part B coverage of terrorism.
Perhaps. Yeah, maybe that's
not a great example, but not a great
parallel. I'm worried I don't know enough about Medicare Part B to confirm that, but something to that effect, certainly. It provides this sort of insurance in the worst case scenario where the insurers can have some confidence that they're not going to be exposed to the truly existential threatening level of damages. And that's proven effective. We saw insurers step in and start providing insurance for this again. And notably, that sort of claim has actually never been used to date.
So the taxpayers haven't had to ante up, even though they could be.
No, not to date. And what we've seen is that in subsequent renewals, they've been kind of a ratcheting back. The threshold at which the federal government will come in has been raised higher and higher, has become a little more demanding. And so it's become a less likely phenomenon in the end.
So
and
do
that's
you urge,
a fairly effective policy.
So do you urge Congress then to extend TRIA to cyber, or maybe just make a whole new bill that looks like TRIA, but it's focused on cyber?
I think what
TRIA.
Something like that. I think what we would like to see is a serious conversation about what role the federal government should be playing in this situation. As we kind of note in our article, there are a lot of parallels between what people were worried about were going to happen in the regards to terrorist damages after 9/11 attacks and with cyber attacks now. And there is the risk that we're going to start seeing insurance market failures regarding this coverage. And cyber insurance, because cyber damages are so ever-present and cyber plays such a role everywhere, cyber insurance is going to be an important part of sustaining healthy economic growth and mitigating risk in the event that there is some sort of large-scale cyber attack or other accident that triggers all sorts of damages related to cyber causes. Because of that, you know, the federal government needs to have a serious conversation about this. This gut instinct to say this is not something for the federal government to step in. Well, you know, we saw a Republican administration that was skeptical of federal intervention in many other ways, but saw this as one spot where it's worth coming in, not to take over the place, not to replace the private market, but to help the private market ensure that it covers these very difficult to predict rare situations where otherwise there might be a market failure. And what we would like to see is that conversation happening. We think there's a good conversation that needs to happen, a good possibility that this might be a good proposal. But the first step is to really start to sit down and start thinking about it seriously. And that's what we're hoping people will do.
Scott Anderson is a fellow in governance studies at the Brookings Institution and senior editor and counsel at Lawfare. Thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
We'll post this interview along with a link to his Lawfare article at federalnewsnetwork.com. I'm Tom Temin.
Disruption waits for no one. So what exactly are you waiting for? At KPMG, we help government agencies embrace new technologies and implement agile operations to meet the needs of a rapidly changing world. We help organizations advance in areas like digital transformation, cognitive analytics, cybersecurity, artificial intelligence, and much more. It's time to turn today's challenges into tomorrow's opportunities. Become future ready with KPMG. Visit futurereadygovernment.com.
When it comes to federal IT systems, the cool people are all into modernization. One operator who's with the program is Todd Simpson, Chief Product Officer in the Health and Human Services Office of the Chief Information Officer. Earlier, I asked Simpson about some of the modernizing efforts. Cybersecurity often gets tied to modernization. I heard one agency say that they're trying to kill as many legacy systems as they can, partly to modernize and get better services, but also to improve cybersecurity. The other school of thought says that the coding is so old on some of the legacy systems that nobody can hack it. So how do the two tie in?
Well, I think any opportunity to reduce your attack vector or I agree with the antiquated code. I'm sure that there are instances where the young hackers just don't know COBOL, or maybe don't know some of the older. But it seems to me that the longer these systems sit around, the more likely candidates to brute force attacks they become. And as we all know, if you keep attacking a vector, you're going to eventually get in. So from my perspective, I think that the new technologies that this new CIO has been bringing to bear, especially around technologies like blockchain, where proven leaders, secure technology, to my knowledge, never been hacked. When we use these new technologies in the right use cases, we create a much more secure environment. In fact, this particular CIO has been very vocal about some innovative concepts around employing the blockchain infrastructure to the security posture of HHS, using blockchain, for example, to capture logs, to ensure that the logs aren't being overwritten, and kind of hackers cleaning up their trails on the way out, using that immutability property inside the blockchain database to further secure the environment. But again, I think as you modernize, you should be thinking about reducing the number of systems as well as changing the security posture, i.e. moving from the on-premise environment into the more secure cloud environments.
And we'll get to that cloud in a moment, but I guess just to keep tugging on the idea of old code, in many cases, legacy systems don't have to be old enough to be COBOL. I mean, we're at a point in history where some of them were programmed in C, you know, common languages mm-hmm. that are still being used, but they're not old enough to be COBOL.
Mm-hmm.
So therefore, there is a cybersecurity risk there that's greater than it would be if it was Fortran or COBOL.
Sure, sure. Yeah, I would agree with that, Tom.
And getting to the blockchain for a moment, I know Jose Arrieta has been talking about that for several years now, and including at prior jobs. What are the use cases specifically in HHS now where this immutable record would seem to bear fruit? You mentioned acquisition.
Yes. Yeah, so there's several use cases, actually. Of course, I mentioned the Accelerate use case where we're capturing contract transactional based data that has that immutability requirement. But then there's also the security log use case that I mentioned, and then there's another use case that I've heard about around using grants. I believe I heard Mike Peckham's name mentioned a couple of times in passing. And I believe I heard Oki Mech refer to a grants blockchain initiative on a federal news radio or an ABC News Matters briefing. But there was some discussion around it. The two that I'm most familiar with are, of course, the Accelerate and the security logging. And definitely very intimately familiar with Accelerate, as Accelerate is my program now in the Chief Product Office.
And as you develop Accelerate and get all of that acquisition data in there and contract performance data, it also gives mm-hmm. you a information store that you can use for better contract management and riding herd on vendors as you move forward, correct?
Absolutely, yes. And there's all kinds of novel little use cases inside of the greater use case. Concepts around ingesting government position descriptions to better define what work is inherently governmental versus what work should be carved out for the contractors, and using that data to expedite the flow of work to the contractor community, so it's easier to come up with the task orders. That's just one example. Now, of course, when we start talking about these kinds of innovations, I have to mention the neural network that is also, it's not actually part of Accelerate. It's an engine or a platform unto itself that we are coupling with Accelerate to be able to do that position description ingestion and other ingestion around other data sets. And then, of course, using the AI and machine learning capabilities and the neural network to get smarter faster. That's definitely something that's happening. And while mentioning that neural network, not only is that a huge innovation experiment and modernization opportunity, but that neural network is also in concept being used in a lot of different areas. In fact, they're talking about pointing that neural network at the HHS vacancies in my own office, in the OCIO office. I think we have some 80-85 vacancies, which this may seem startling to you, but we are a very large organization, so it's relative. But nevertheless, when our CIO found out that he had that vacancy rate, he immediately started coming up with concepts around applying the neural network to that problem. And that's one of the cool things I think Jose brings to the table. He's not a very linear person. He thinks outside of the box, and he isn't afraid to kind of throw anything at the problem to try to solve it.
When I think of HHS, of course, you think of NIH and CDC and FDA, and also the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, CMS. How do you incorporate all of their modernizing needs? And they have their own plans and programs, but does it somehow roll up to some cogent view from the HHS level?
Yeah. So actually, I think that's really where Jose's ideas around cloud and, well, specifically cloud, really come to bear. If you look at HHS, there's not a whole lot that HHS can do for the larger Optives that the larger Optives can't do for themselves. We look to HHS to provide kind of that high-level governance, high-level policy, and in the vein of governance, I would offer that it's Jose's role as the departmental CIO to identify those cloud service providers that can offer the kind of service that that the Optives need while still affording the interoperability that Jose needs. So maybe FDA isn't thinking about if CMS is going to need to use portions of the system, and they can do that at FDA. Jose can't afford to do that. His role is to ensure that there's as little duplication taking place as possible and as much interoperability taking place as possible, and that there's scalability in the solutions that the small Optives or that the Optives, small or large, are using. And I think that Jose and, you know, some of these questions, you know, he could probably answer more thoroughly than me. But I think what Jose is doing to try to get ahead of some of this stuff and to ensure that he's breaking down the silos and getting everybody on the same sheet of music is just being very engaging. He's calling CIO council meetings regularly, very consistent. We've spent about 5 hours in the last 2 weeks with the agency CIOs. That's a lot of time to spend with the CIOs. And I think that it's needed because, you know, the relationships they're in need of some nurturing. Let me just put it that way. And I think that Jose has the right approach and the right temperament and the right attitude to kind of pull everyone together and to get everyone to start thinking about their cloud brokerage models, the symmetries between the cloud brokerage models and the overall strategy that we're all trying to move toward.
Todd Simpson is the Chief Product Officer in the Office of the CIO at Health and Human Services. Find more of the interview at federalnewsnetwork.com. I'm Tom Temin.
Thank you to listening to Federal Insights for October, sponsored by KPMG on Federal News Radio, part of the Federal News Network.
Innovation. Everyone says it. At KPMG, we know actions speak louder than words. For over 100 years, KPMG has helped federal agencies adapt to changing times with innovative approaches. Today, we're helping agencies advance in areas like cybersecurity, artificial intelligence, blockchain, cognitive analytics, and secure cloud. Let our past experience help propel your future forward more quickly and with greater agility and efficiency. Become future ready with KPMG. Visit futurereadygovernment.com. Disruption waits for no one. So what exactly are you waiting for? At KPMG, we help government agencies embrace new technologies and implement agile operations to meet the needs of a rapidly changing world. We help organizations advance in areas like digital transformation, cognitive analytics, cybersecurity, artificial intelligence, and much more. It's time to turn today's challenges into tomorrow's opportunities. Become future ready with KPMG. Visit futurereadygovernment.com.